This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is April 29th, 2021, and this is episode 237. I'm Scott DeLunnebohm.
And I'm Shannon Waters.
Shannon, thank you for joining us today and filling in for Ian as he is busy moving out to suburbia.
Yeah, big move there, and always a delight to be on the show and have the chance to talk about BC politics.
So yeah, on today's show, we're going to go through the last week or so of BC politics, just a grab bag of everything that's been going on provincially here, or at least the highlights. But first, we got to thank the 105 people who contribute to the show every month. Thanks to our newest patrons, Anthony and Jordan. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/politicoast. Well, let's jump right into it then. Travel restrictions are apparently maybe happening, maybe not. I'm a little confused on everything that's going on here. We talked about this last week as it was on the eve of the details being announced.
Ah, but there are more details to come.
Yeah, so the Friday after we recorded, when the show dropped, we got the basics of the travel restrictions that the north is basically going to be one big area, the lower mainland the other, and then Vancouver Island's off on its own. So there's kind of three provincial zones that we may not be able to travel between, but it's not entirely clear. And the Albertans can just come in. They might have to pass a sternly worded sign, and that's about it.
Yeah, I think, so I spent some time tuning into the announcement last Friday, and I think I made a list of the things that were new, like that we hadn't heard of before, and one was the zones, like what the different provincial regions are. One was that the amount of the fine that you could face if you are caught by law enforcement traveling outside of your zone for non-essential reasons, and then they also gave a list of these are the essential reasons for which you are allowed to travel around the province. And I think that was about it. We did not get any details on how the actual law enforcement side of things was going to work, which was a big question mark for everybody. And now we are told we will get those details tomorrow.
So this will be what, like nearly 2 weeks since the first announcement on going to be doing this?
Depends on how you count. It was a Monday. It was a week this past Monday since the premier announced that travel restrictions were coming and you weren't going to be able to travel out of your local area without facing fines. That was a day where media had sat through a fairly extensive technical briefing and there had been like a passing mention of the fact that travel restrictions might be considered. And then Horgan just goes off and starts talking about how we're going to have all these restrictions, and then everybody is asking all these questions, and they're like, oh, simmer down, we'll get you the details at the end of the week. And then they didn't really do that, and now we're told that we'll get them tomorrow, which is another full week from when they told us we were going to have all the details on this thing.
So I haven't been tuning into any of the press conferences this week. Yeah, I've had my own work busyness to keep me distracted from that. But has there been any indication at all this week on how they're going to shape up?
Not much. We have most of the information that I have become aware of has actually come out during question period because the Liberals have been pressing for more details and saying people are confused. They don't understand how the system is going to work and what the role of law enforcement is going to be, what the penalties are going to be. And the government, the public safety minister and the premier keep insisting that they've been very clear and that basically you should just stay home. And if you stay mostly at home or in your community, then you won't have any issues at all. Meanwhile, organizations like the BC Civil Liberties Association are raising concerns over the role of law enforcement and the relationship that, you know, racialized people have with law enforcement and tending to attract more police attention than, say, white people do. And we've also had police organizations saying, we want to know what the details are, or saying that they think the province should back off the whole travel restriction thing entirely, and that they don't want to play a role. They don't want to have to be enforcing this. So it will be interesting to see what comes out tomorrow. One of the things that the public safety minister has repeated is that it's not like they're going to be manning every single boundary or entry point across these boundaries for the provincial regions. They're likely to focus on, say, the BC Ferry terminals, or major routes that cross the province. So like Highway 1 going up to the Coquihalla, all these points where if you're driving along those stretches of road, you could be going somewhere for essential business, but you could be trying to travel to other parts of the province in order to vacation or whatever, which you're not supposed to be doing right now.
So that kind of makes sense. For the most part, with the exception of, I think, the Fraser and Vancouver boundaries, for them, they're pretty much all have the boundaries going through the mountains and places away from actual large settlements of any kind. So it made sense that would be how they do that. But like right now, we've, in theory, had the travel restrictions in place for a week, or at least since the announcement that they were being brought in. If I was to get in my car right now and start driving to Kelowna, would anyone actually stop me before I got there?
I have no idea. We were told that some people who tried to get on BC ferries over the weekend were told that their travel was non-essential and they weren't allowed on board. But that's the only sort of instance I'm aware of, and I don't have any details on that front. But I think to a certain degree, yes, it does make sense. And yes, it is quite simple. If you don't need to go somewhere, like it's not, you know, going to impact your ability to earn a living or feed yourself, take care of your family, then yes, you should be staying home. And if you do that, you don't really have to worry about any of this stuff. At the same time, like they've made one region out of the almost 2/3 of the province. And technically, if you're just driving around between like interior health and northern health, you shouldn't have an issue anyways, even though the province is saying, you know, really you should stay local and stay home. And yet they amalgamated the northern and interior health regions, which I think sends a mixed signal. It's the same thing here on the island. They're saying stay home, but people are like, Tofino is part of the island health region, so why can't I go to Tofino? Because it's within the region, the health region that I live in, even if I say live in Nanaimo or Victoria, which are a couple hours away. The enforcement thing, I think, basically will tell people this is the risk that you're going to take if you're going to push the issue. We don't know if law enforcement is actually going to have the power to detain people. That was something that came up in question period. What kind of proof would you have that your travel is essential? If you just say, hey, I'm going to a medical appointment, is that going to be good enough? Or are you going to have a, you know, note from the specialist you're going to see or something like that? So yeah, I do think that they probably could have rolled this out, as with so many things, a lot more smoothly and intuitively, but here we are, and we will supposedly know more tomorrow.
Not just smoothly and intuitively, but quicker too. It's not that hard to move some resources around and actually put in place the limitations on. And yeah, I realize there's going to be edge cases and complications, but it would seem to be much easier, or not necessarily easier, but because it is a crisis and it's one of those things where you need to move fast, because every second you waste is the opportunity to introduce new clusters and have spread into communities that currently have low case counts. Why take 2 weeks to do it? Why not move quickly, put the measures in place, and revise as needed? It almost seems like the government's so worried about making a misstep here that they're dragging it out longer than it needs to be. But I honestly think British Columbians, if they were told up front, it's a crisis, we're moving this quickly. We're going to adjust as the situation develops. There would probably be a fair bit of public understanding on that.
Yeah, I do think that the situation that occurred in Ontario is likely playing a role here, or possibly taking up some space in the politicians' heads. That was Ontario essentially granting police sweeping powers to stop people and say, why are you out and about, kind of thing. And then it did take a couple days, but like almost immediately walking all of that back, because there was so much backlash and a lot of people identified large potential for abuse, et cetera, was it even going to be that effective, that kind of thing. So I do think that's could be playing a role in what we're seeing here, this sort of like very cautious, like half a step at a time rollout. But yeah, there's still part of me that's skeptical that we're even going to have a good understanding of what's going on tomorrow because of what we've seen the past couple times we've talked about these new restrictions.
What do you mean? Their communications could not have been clearer from what I'm hearing.
I have heard that too, but I don't know that I agree with that characterization.
Speaking of things that could have been clearer and have been a little slow to roll out, let's switch gears a bit to vaccines. You had some reporting today about potential changes to how the province is going to be handling the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines.
Yes. So this is a story that took me about a week to wrestle down. And basically, I was curious about how the new disruption in Moderna deliveries, so we're getting about half, Canada as a whole is getting about half of what was expected over this month. And we are told that deliveries, I believe, will start again on May 10th. I'm not sure about volume at this point in time, but it's one of several disruptions that have happened with the Moderna supply. BC is still administering new shots of Moderna, but there is a population of people, many of them frontline healthcare workers, some of them working in long-term care, who received a Moderna shot just before BC switched, or even a little ways before BC switched, to the 4-month vaccination interval, and are now coming up to the end of that 4-month vaccination interval, and we don't have a good handle on the province's supply of Moderna. So I was asking what BC's plan was if, say, there's another disruption and we just don't have any, what are they going to do with these people who need their second shot? Because the 4-month interval really is the end of the runway, so to speak. At first, it was a 28-day interval that Moderna was supposed to be administered under, and then BC extended it to 42 days, and then we extended it to 4 months, just right off the top. And so the health ministry did confirm that they are considering, if needed, rather than extending that interval any further, they are going to offer people Pfizer shots for their second dose, which theoretically should work well. They are a similar structure of vaccine, but the thing is that there's really no scientific evidence out there as to what the risks of delivering two different shots might be, or what the benefits might be. We just don't know. As with so many things when it comes to COVID, we're learning as we go. And so this is a potential shortcoming or downside to BC's vaccinate as many people as quickly as possible strategy that was decided early on. We would just start doling out first shots and figure out the second shots later. So it'll be interesting to see if we get to that point. For many people who are approaching that 4-month window, it'll be mid-May, end of May, that they will run out and need their second shot. And so we'll see what happens there. But the other thing that I thought was interesting, and we've already talked about the province's communication issues, the BC Care Providers Association didn't have much to say. They said they'd heard nothing from the health ministry on that front. The BC Nurses Union said that the provincial health officer had flagged the possibility of mixing mRNA vaccines to them, but said they couldn't comment because there's no science behind it, and also they haven't heard much from the province. And then the Nurses and Nurse Practitioners Association also said they'd heard nothing and that they would like the province to communicate its sort of decision-making process on that front and keep people in the loop.
So that's a thing I hear more and more these days is a desire for the province to be clear on just how it's deciding things.
Yeah, I mean, it is sort of a recurring theme. And like, speaking of second shots, there's been a lot of confusion as to how people are supposed to sign up to get their second dose of AstraZeneca for certain. So they've opened it up to everybody over 40. And then in certain areas, there is some access for people 30 and over to get AstraZeneca. The supply is still very constrained. And so there's not a lot of it out there. But that is mostly being delivered through pharmacies. And again, there seems to have been like poor communication or some confusion or misunderstanding around how people were going to get booked for their second dose.
Right. I've heard people say that they were either told they had to be responsible themselves or that the place they got it from for their first shot would contact them as needed. And both messages seem to be out there.
Yeah, and I believe that people basically should make sure that they're registered within the province's system, and specifically if they've received AstraZeneca recently, they need to either complete their registration or check it in May. Again, it's one of those issues that I haven't followed super closely, so I'm not 100% clear on it, but it was really interesting. Again, this was an issue that came up during question period. Health critic Renee Merrifield asked the health minister, like, how is this going to work? How are people supposed to do this? And Dix was basically just, we'll figure it out by the time we get to August. And it's been like 16 weeks since people got their first shots. Like, there's lots of time for us to figure out how this is going to work. Just people are anxious. People want to know that the system is set up to work properly, and they definitely don't want to be missing their second dose of a COVID vaccine. And the health minister is just, it's fine. We'll figure it out before we get there. It's fine.
I'd be more reassured by the, we'll figure it out, we've got time, if it wasn't a year into this thing and they have already had a year to try and figure out how they were going to vaccinate everyone. And what, like 6 months now, almost, since, maybe a little longer, maybe a little less, since we started the first vaccinations in the province. How much more time do they really need? And if they haven't figured it out by now, is 16 weeks going to be enough?
I have to say, I don't envy the people who are trying to work out the logistics on this kind of stuff, because so much changes so quickly. We get told that we're getting vaccine doses, and then maybe we get more than we were expecting. Oftentimes we get less than we were expecting. The province has like a multi-pronged strategy to deliver those doses. There's the age-based rollout. There's the clinically vulnerable people rollout. There's focus on workplaces. There's focus on hotspots. Like, it's just, the logistics are absolutely insane. On one hand, I do think it is to be expected that there's going to be some confusion, some frustration, some anxiety around this process. But yeah, one of the best ways to manage that, it seems to me, is to at least have your communications being clear and organized and trying to get people the information that they want and need when they want and need it, and not saying, hey, just trust us, it'll be fine like 4 months from now.
Yeah, I've had a little bit of experience on the workplace side, and it has not been particularly clear. I finally found out this week that we're not eligible for the workplace one, even though it sounded like that from some of the initial ones. We're all on our own, which is not great, but also not unexpected, seeing how everything else has played out. So, yeah, no, it's a mess. Moving back a bit to the mRNA stuff. Now, I gather we tend to get the Moderna in a kind of monthly batch, once a month, if everything's going well on their production side, they ship it in. Do you know if they're still giving out new Moderna doses, or are they holding everything back for the people who had their first one?
No, so that was part of what prompted my inquiry. In the technical briefing that we had, where we were told about utilizations and vaccination, and then the premier did his little travel restrictions are coming, and nobody talked about hospitalizations or vaccination for a while. During the briefing, we were told that the remaining or the reduced Moderna supply would still be part of the age-based rollout that BC. At the time, it was people 63 and up who were still eligible to be booked for vaccine appointments. Now I think we're down to about 56-year-olds. And so yes, Moderna is still playing a role in first shots delivered, which was a little bit surprising to me with the supply being so tenuous. But
yeah, that seems really risky as a strategy when there's these big question marks on whether we'll get another batch in the time we're expecting for the second doses.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what the Nurses and Nurse Practitioners Association said to me, is like, this, it was all, the age-based thing was always a bit risky if there were supply disruptions. And when BC switched to this 4-month interval for Pfizer and Moderna, that was back at the beginning of March, there was basically no communication to a lot of these frontline healthcare workers. And some of them actually showed up to get their second shot and then were just told, oh, sorry, like it's canceled and you're going to have to wait for a couple more months. So I think they'd really like to see not a repeat of that happening where people get their appointments booked and then they're like, oh, by the way, you're getting Pfizer instead of Moderna. Not that's necessarily a bad thing. It's obviously not ideal. Theoretically, it should work. There are studies ongoing as to if there are any pressing issues on that front. But just informing people ahead of time, allowing them some time to process information, to do their own sort of risk assessment. Is it better? And I would argue that it is to have closer to get your full protection, to get both doses of the vaccine, than to wait and get one that is matched. But it's also not clear to me why the province isn't, say, reserving some of that Moderna supply to make sure that they can vaccinate everyone. Now, the other thing that the ministry pointed out when I made my inquiry was that currently we are still expecting to get more Moderna doses this quarter, so in the second quarter of 2021, than we got in the first quarter of 2021. So theoretically, they should, and some people have already received their second doses, so theoretically they should be fine. But if we end up with another delivery issue or something happens and some of the supply is damaged, then they could end up in a position where they do need to mix mRNA shots in order to get everybody vaccinated.
Yeah, it's been a little kind of hit and miss on the deliveries, and in some ways that's understandable. I don't think they actually had a vaccine in mass production prior to the pandemic. They're a pretty new company, so it's not a surprise they're having some issues on there. But you think the government would take that into account after a couple months of experience on the hit and miss nature of the deliveries from Moderna?
Yeah, like I said, I was a bit surprised on that front, but by their calculations, they should still have more shots this quarter than last, and everything should be fine. It might be a moot point, but we'll see in a few weeks.
I guess the only other thing to mention on the vaccines before we move on is it's a bit of a kerfuffle as well with the new AstraZeneca changes and the pop-up clinics that have come and apparently are now gone over the last couple days.
I saw a really good headline on the pop-up clinics, which was pop-up clinics go poof after I think they did 3 days or did 3 days. I'm not 100% clear whether there were actually pop-up clinics today, but they seem to have, the health minister actually admitted they caused a lot of confusion and they may have damaged some people's confidence in the vaccine rollout, which is obviously very not good. But they also delivered a lot of shots to people, like several thousand people got shots through those clinics. Nevertheless, Fraser Health is backing off of them, at least for now, and supposedly learning some lessons from the whole situation and potentially rethinking its strategy for vaccinating people who live in hotspots.
Yeah, those were another situation where the communications were pretty, was it Monday night, Tuesday morning, I started to see people posting, hey, there's shots available out in, I think it was Coquitlam was the one I saw, but there's, I think, a couple in Surrey as well. If you can get out there, you can get some your vaccine if you're in the plus 30 group. And it just really seemed to be one of those situations where suddenly there was a new vaccine clinic that nobody knew about, and it was all word of mouth.
Yeah, word of mouth and a lot of social media and a lot of, I think especially yesterday, a lot of frustrated people who spent a lot of time in lineups trying to get shots. And yeah, it was messy. It was definitely very messy. And it's not often in this pandemic that I have heard a member of the government just fully admitting, yeah, this didn't go well, and we're going to try and learn from our mistakes kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't even think it's that bad an idea, but you just
not
having
well
it kind
executed.
Of...
Yeah. Not well executed.
Not well executed, but the idea of kind of sending people out into the communities, maybe with a little more notice, and I don't know, like they do at stores when they're selling in like a new release of a limited item, they like give little tickets or something out to the people in line, so anyone who doesn't get one knows they don't have to wait around for 8 hours or something.
Well, yeah, communicating with people who are in line. The other concern that was raised was that there really wasn't much being done to ensure that the people who showed up actually lived in hotspot areas. So some suggestion that people may have driven from other parts of the Lower Mainland for a chance to get a shot.
Definitely heard those rumors.
Yeah, the opposition in question period pointed out that the pop-up clinics could favor people who aren't working right now, because if you're working a 9-to-5 type job, you probably can't go and stand in a line for several hours on a weekday. Also favor people who are on social media and
from home, where you can duck out for a couple hours and nobody's really the wiser.
Yeah, and also like language barrier issues. The fact that a lot of the communication was done in English. And so if you're someone who is not a native speaker, English speaker, or not a particularly strong English speaker, you just might not have been able to access the information needed to get there. And that's been a problem in a lot of aspects of the province's response to the pandemic, language right. barrier issues.
The not checking residency one's interesting, because I remember that was a big deal with the Whistler vaccine surge they did, is that the province was very clear that they were going to be checking people's residencies in that distribution. It's interesting that they didn't bother in this case.
Especially when the whole point was supposed to be vaccinating people who are living in areas of very high transmission. And yes, the Lower Mainland is one region in many aspects. A lot of people work in one area and live in another or travel around it. But we are seeing differences in transmission in various health service delivery areas that are noticeable. And so that the point of these clinics was supposed to be getting vaccinations to those people, and yet there didn't seem to be a mechanism to ensure that's what was actually happening.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole thing sounds like a bit of a mess, as does the province's tentative baby steps towards sick leave that may or may not be coming. So it's, I think, a little surprising that the NDP got beat to the sick leave thing by Doug Ford after a year of this thing.
Yeah, that's a weird one. Although Ontario's doing 3 days, which, given how long people tend to be sick with COVID, really doesn't seem like enough. But anyway,
you really need to do 2 weeks minimum on that.
Yeah, they usually say, I think, symptom onset is somewhere between 3 to 5 or around 5 days. And then by day 14, you're supposed to be starting to come out of it. But yeah, so 3 days probably isn't going to cut it. BC, meanwhile, has been talking about a provincial plan for a year now, like literally a year. The premier likes to take credit for there being a national plan at all, that this was an issue that he championed, the need for a federal paid sick leave program so that workers weren't having to decide between having their salaries docked and going to work while not feeling well, which obviously became a lot more pressing when we got to COVID than it, say, had, you know, before. And then back in December, when it became quite, the dust from the election had settled, it became quite evident that the national plan wasn't really cutting it for a lot of people for various reasons. Horgan once again said, we've got a plan that's ready to go. We can roll it out. We've done like the work, but we haven't seen the data that suggests that it's needed. And he also expressed some concern about, you know, a sick pay program putting a burden on employers that they could not handle at this point in time. And so here we are, like almost 5 months since the last time he said we were ready to go with a plan. And now We're told that the legislation to enact one could be introduced right after the constituency week break that is coming up next week.
It's the middle of the third wave. It's not like there's any urgency to getting people out of the workplace who are sick.
Well, and it's one of those things that, like, can you imagine if they'd done this last year? Like, what a difference that could have made, potentially, and we'll never know, but, like, potentially in the fall wave, like the second wave and then in the third wave, if people could just say, you know what, I don't feel 100% today, and I'm worried that it could be COVID, and I'm just going to stay home. And if I feel better tomorrow, then I'll go to work. But if I don't, maybe start looking at getting tested. What a difference that could have made, might have made, in the number of people who have gotten sick and the number of people who have died.
Yeah, and I don't have the data in front of me, but I believe workplace transmissions are a sizable amount of the total cases that at least there's any sort of contact tracing or tracking on.
Yeah, I've seen 40% kicked around at times, and we have seen upwards of 100 businesses, most of them in the lower mainland, get shut down due to 3 or more cases in the workplace thought to be linked to transmission in the workplace. And that's another thing where it's, okay, so we've asked employers to put plans in place to prevent transmission. Obviously, there are going to be challenges to that, especially in certain workplaces, but it really seemed like the province was basically admitting, okay, we haven't been enforcing this in the way that we need to. So now we're actually going to start shutting businesses down for 10 days if 3 people in the workplace get sick. And again, like, why couldn't they have started doing that last summer or in the fall? And again, how many infections would that have stopped? So, yeah, we'll see what happens on the sick pay program. I'm at the point where I'm like, I'll believe it when I see it.
It's like the Liberals' famed pharmacare that they've been running on for, what, like 20 years now or 30 years?
Yeah.
It's starting to feel like that sick leave is Horgan's pharmacare.
And, like, complicated, and it would in some ways, as I understand it, be easier for Ottawa to just take the lead on this, but they have said fairly directly that they're not interested in changing the program that they have, and that the pandemic sick pay program is only meant to fill in the gaps. I don't really know what they mean by that, because most provinces don't require paid sick leave, so there's a lot of gap there that needs to be filled, really.
Yeah, I don't get the easier thing, because with the exception of, what, federally regulated industries, which are banking, telecoms, railroads, not the places that I gather there's been a huge amount of transmission in compared to the manufacturing-type places, the service delivery places, all the things that are really regulated at the provincial level. Like, it's ultimately the province's job to cover most workplaces in the province on regulations like this. So the only thing I can think of is that it's cheaper and they don't want to actually spend the money to do this, which they're putting out, what, $13 billion deficit? I can't recall what the most, I think it was 11 to 13 in that range. That was their latest deficit. You know, what's another billion or so onto that to tackle it for a year or two?
Sorry, go ahead.
It really seems like this is the case of them being oddly stingy with money on this one.
The money, I think, is going to be the sticking point. Everybody's trying to figure out where it's going to come from at this point. On the sort of federal side of things, my understanding is that it's the delivery side that's a bit more complicated. And at least the premier's suggestion has been that it would be easiest for Ottawa to just build it onto the existing EI system, which the provinces don't have the same level of access to. But yeah, I mean, it could be expensive. It's likely to be expensive. And again, this week in question period, the Liberals brought up, what are the details on this plan? How is it going to work? Which is when we heard the premier say, we could be bringing this to the legislature when we get back from the constituency break. He has suggested that WorkSafe BC is going to have a role to play in it, which makes sense. Although on the money side of things, I'll be interested to see how that works. The Liberals, on the other hand, don't want employers to have to pay any part of it and have suggested that the NDP use a little over $1 billion in unallocated contingencies from budget 2021 to cover the program. The other question is whether this is just a pandemic program that exists, or whether BC actually goes ahead and mandates permanent paid sick leave for workers.
I mean, it was probably a good idea to do permanent. It's not like we had particularly healthy norms around working sick before the pandemic. The flu kills a lot of people. It's probably not a bad idea to just keep this up afterwards. But I kind of get the Liberals' point on the not wanting businesses to have to cover too much, but particularly the small businesses who don't have a huge amount of excess financial capacity at the best of times, and this really is not the best of times. So it made sense for at least the smaller businesses for the province to help them out a bit on the costs. But like you said, there's a lot of money unallocated right now, and it's not like the government is being particularly spending adverse anywhere else, which makes this whole thing just really weird to me. I can't quite figure out what the thinking is in Victoria on this one.
Yeah, but it'll be interesting to see where it goes. It's one of those issues that like pops up like at the beginning of the pandemic. Everybody was asking about it for a while, and then Ottawa's program rolled out, and then it dropped off the radar for a bit. And then it popped up again after the election, and then Christmas time happened, and now it's back. So we'll see if it actually goes anywhere in terms of becoming a reality, or whether the can just keeps getting kicked down the road until we're post-pandemic, and then there's probably a lot less appetite for it.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see. So the constituency break is, I believe, a week, and we should find out probably, what, second week of May? If we're getting sick leave and what that looks like?
It will depend. Yeah, like I said, the premier said they could be bringing it right after the constituency week. Spring sittings are always busy because they have to get through all the estimates, so they don't tend to be huge on legislation. There's a couple of big bills, and then a lot of the rest of it is routine. It'll be interesting to see if they bring the paid sick leave program to the legislature to be debated how it goes, because BC recently just introduced paid leave for people when they need to go get their COVID shots. So basically, like when you go to vote, depending on how your workday goes, you are entitled to a couple hours to make sure that you can cast your ballot and your boss isn't allowed to dock your paycheck for that. So it's going to be the same thing with COVID shots. Get up to 3 hours, I believe it is, to get to your appointment and stuff like that. Now, Alberta introduced a similar piece of legislation the same week BC did and passed it in a single day. Unanimous support, I believe. It just flew through the House and everybody was so happy. And I don't know how closely people follow Alberta politics, but that's not how that legislature works ever on anything, really.
So Horgan's getting laughed by both Ford and Kenny on pandemic?
On certain parts of it, but this one I'm not sure you can blame the NDP for, because it got hung up at committee stage by the Liberals and was debated extensively in a way that I don't think was expected by the government at all. So they spent 4 days, basically, well over 5 hours, I believe, when I counted it all up, at committee stage alone on this piece of legislation. And it finally passed, and it was retroactive to the day it was introduced, so it really doesn't even make that much difference. But if the Liberals are going to go over a piece of legislation like that, which is 3 hours of paid leave with a fine-tooth comb, you can imagine the kind of detail that they may apply to legislation for paid sick leave.
Well, I guess all the more reason to get a move on with that. Speaking of legislation going through the legislature, it's not the most elegant turn of phrase, let's cover off a couple of the big bills that have been introduced in the sitting so far. So this week we got a couple of them.
We did get several. There had not been much.
Yeah, so I think the kind of couple big ones are a significant bill on accessibility legislation, as well as a in BC Investment Corp. Could you walk us through what's come up for new legislation in the last little bit?
Yeah, so the accessibility piece was promised by the NDP. It was flagged in the throne speech that it was coming this session. And basically, BC is going to develop standards when it comes to accessibility, standards that will apply to things like work, the workplace, service delivery, as well as the built environment, which is, I think, how most people think of accessibility standards, making sure like wheelchair ramps, curb cuts, accessible doorways, that kind of thing. So it was the first bill that Social Development and Poverty Reduction Minister Nicholas Simons has ever introduced, and it has not gone up for debate yet. So we haven't heard much about it. It was introduced on yesterday, I believe. So yeah, it's again something that has been promised that I think realizes some of the rhetoric that the NDP has around inclusion when it comes to people in BC. And so part of the goal, I think, is having everybody on the same page while also complementing the federal standards that already exist on this front.
Do we know what kind of form those standards are likely to take? Or is it in the legislation, or is this one of those things where it empowers the cabinet to make a bunch of regulations?
As with many things, so it is a big bill. I will admit I haven't gone through and read the whole thing at this point. A lot of it will, basically, my understanding is there's broad categories, like where are the areas that we are going to set standards for and who is going to be responsible for upholding the standards, applying them, etc. But a lot of it will come out in regulation. And we'll hear a bit more about that once we actually get to some debate on the bill, so when I first started reporting, I would always like try to read the legislation as soon as it came out, which, you know, is a good thing to do, but also it's difficult sometimes to even understand the legislation just because of the way it's written. So now I'll often wait until debate starts and then start pulling more out of it at that point when I can understand how the different clauses are going to be applied and things like that.
Yeah, I think that's probably a overdue piece of legislation that's good to see introduced. The other big one this week was a $500 billion fund, which was announced in the budget, I think, and actually first got hinted at back in September, but there wasn't much details to fill it out, is a BC Investment Corporation.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we first heard about this back in September, which feels like ages ago. Basically that the money was there and that the legislation would be coming. So it's going to be a new crown corporation. That's part of what the legislation does, is make NBC Investment Corp Act will make this fund into its standalone crown corporation. And basically, it is going to be looking at growing, particularly the tech sector here in BC, is my impression, based on what we were told and the way it's been talked about so far.
Government-owned VC firm, more or less? Venture capital?
Yeah. And it's got they're calling it the triple bottom line mandate, which I believe the premier's turn of phrase for the whole thing was people, planet, and profit. So it's not just about making money, although that is part of the goal, but it's about nurturing talent here in the province. And one of the other things that got brought up by some of the stakeholders who were there at the announcement was that BC develops a lot of companies. There are a lot of companies that get their start here in BC. And then as they scale up, they either get moved to other jurisdictions or they get sold off rather than staying and growing within the province. So that is something that this new Crown Corp is going to look at addressing, providing ways for companies to get access to the capital that they need to scale up here in the province rather than moving elsewhere.
And how much direction is there going to be from the government on this? Because one of the problems that can always come up in this is that it becomes a tool of political convenience more than a serious economic growth strategy that really tries to maximize its potential. Is this going to be the sort of thing where every new government is going to be using it to throw money around in their favorite places, or is it going to be fully hands-off?
The legislation seeks to make it more of a hands-off situation. So the NBC's policy objectives will be set via a mandate letter that is going to be coming out from the jobs and finance minister. I imagine it will be similar to the letters that ministers themselves get, which are outline a broad swath of policy objectives and things that they are supposed to work on or realize during their time as minister. However, the investment decisions themselves will only be up to NBC's chief investment officer. So government ministers, the corporation's board, and its CEO will all be barred from influencing those decisions, at least formally. So there is an emphasis on independence there when it comes to where the money goes.
Okay. The other thing I've often heard, and I'm not involved in the tech sector, so this is all kind of second or third hand, is that one of the big problems with getting investments for tech companies isn't so much the lack of funds available, although that can be a challenge. It's that the general kind of business and investing culture in BC and Canada more generally is very conservative and slow moving. It's not clear from looking at this that's something that this is really able to address or change. Is this something that there's been any indication that the government is seriously thinking about, or has that kind of not been factored into this from what you can tell?
There was certainly a lot of language around like boldness, and I got a quote from the Business Council of BC President and CEO Greg Davignon saying that it's going to help BC leap into the economy of the 21st century. So there does seem to be some recognition that there needs to be a bit of a jump start here. It's also being rolled into, you know, the recovery, economic recovery side of things. Like BC is going to have to build back from the pandemic, and this is going to be part of how we get that side of things rolling. Again, there's still quite a few moving parts here that haven't been defined yet. We haven't seen that mandate letter about policy objectives. The legislation was at second reading debate today, so not really into the sort of meaty side of things yet. They haven't, obviously, since the legislation is still being debated, we don't know who the CEO is going to be. We don't know who the chief investment officer is going to be. And we don't know what their compensation is going to be like. So this was something that came up during the tech briefing that media was given. One of the things that is sometimes criticized about these investment bodies that are run by the province is that the people who are running them make a lot of money for the work that they do. Now, the counter argument to that tends to be, well, if you want people to work in the public sector as opposed to the private sector, like you have to offer them something fairly competitive. But at this point, we don't know how the people who are running this new Crown Corporation are going to be paid. I would expect it would be fairly significant. And again, we don't know who it is who's going to be running the show yet, and we won't until the legislation passes and probably sometime after that.
Well, I guess the last kind of bill of note was one that was introduced today, I believe. That'll be, I think, of interest to anyone who follows the local political scene, because the province is moving to do the thing that they've already said they'd done or allowed, which was let municipalities designate spaces within their jurisdiction for the public consumption of alcohol. And here in Vancouver, there's been I think it's almost 2 years now, the park board has been in the process of trying to study and implement this for a while, and it's been in a months-long standoff with the province over whether or not they have the ability to let people consume alcohol in the park. So a widespread activity that is de facto legal here for the most part. And yet, the position of the province is, yeah, you could do it, but the park board apparently wasn't satisfied with that and has been holding off. But this bill is an attempt to clarify that and extend beyond the pandemic emergency authorizations as well.
Yeah, so it will make permanent a ministerial order that came out, I don't know, last spring sometime, allowing municipalities to designate certain public areas for alcohol consumption, since you couldn't go to the bar anymore. And so now, basically, municipalities will have the option to continue doing that if they so choose, having parks or other public areas where people are allowed to bring their own alcohol after the provincial state of emergency eventually ends at some point in the future. We've now been in a provincial state of emergency for like over a year, and it gets renewed on a 2-week basis. So who knows when that's going to be. And then, yes, specifically clarifying things for the Vancouver Park Board on that front.
They should have just taken the opportunity to just abolish the park board while they were messing around with this. But alas, that did not appear to be in the cards. Useless body that's taken 2 years to do the thing the province told them they could do already. But regardless, it's good and going to be nice. My apartment does not have a balcony, but is right across from Dude Chillin Park. So it'll be nice that it's going to be fully above board when I opt to consume a beverage there or two.
I actually have no idea what Victoria's rules are when it comes to like public consumption of alcohol, nor has it been a problem for me as a white woman on the occasions where I have consumed alcohol in public places where it probably wasn't allowed.
Yeah, anyway, it's a good move and I think long overdue. I know there's a couple municipalities here have been a lot quicker on that. I can't recall which of the Tri-Cities has moved pretty quickly on it. I think Delta's done a fair bit of relaxation on their rules around it, but it'll be good that this will now be a longer-term change. So I'm happy to see that. The other thing I noticed when I was popping open the various bills on the legislature website is that despite the fact that everyone was focusing on the drinking in parks aspect of it, most of the bill was actually about changes to cannabis legislation.
Yeah, I think that kind of got lost in the shuffle a little bit. Although from what I have seen so far, and I did skip around in that bill, partly because I missed its introduction in the House, it's mostly housekeeping stuff. So, you know, like clarifications of, you know, things that have become issues since legislation was written. The public safety minister, when he introduced it, said explicitly, this does not change any of the province's policies on cannabis. And as far as I can tell at this point, that does appear to be true. It's more, like I said, what they call housekeeping changes to existing law.
Yeah, it looks like mostly stuff around fine-tuning the licensing rules and a few things like that. And then it's like, I'm just opening up here. There's one part where they're changing like the language from federal producer to federal license holder and like little things like that. But I haven't gone through it with a fine tooth comb, but it does seem like the alcohol part stole the headlines.
Yeah. And it's interesting because like I used to, it's weird thinking about it now. I used to spend a lot of time like covering BC's cannabis laws and the sector and stuff like that, and it's something that's just really fallen off my radar since the pandemic hit. I no longer have the time to pour into that.
Yeah, it's amazing how this last year's focused everyone down on just a couple things.
Yeah, the pandemic sucks a lot of the oxygen out of the room, as it were. But yeah, BC is still not making a lot of money from cannabis and the black market is still going strong. So it will be interesting to see if there are any other changes that maybe come up down the road. I know farm gate sales are something that smaller producers in the industry have really been pushing for, but the province doesn't seem to have had much interest in. And that's another issue is BC has so many small scale producers, many of whom are not actually formally licensed, although the province has introduced programs to help them go legit, that, yeah, there's still a lot of frustration, I think, out there from people about the way that the province has approached cannabis legalization. And BC's got the reputation for being a cannabis capital, I don't know about of the world, but...
Yeah, definitely a bit of a reputation on that front. Yeah, I don't use the stuff, but I gather from the little bits I have heard that there's not been a huge incentive for people to switch their suppliers over to the government-run stores.
Yeah, and there's been issues with quality from the legal stuff, and yeah, it's just, but again, one of those things that with the pandemic just doesn't, it hasn't been getting talked about all that much recently.
Okay, Shannon, thanks for joining me tonight. I realized I didn't actually introduce you at the start, but you've been on the podcast enough, and whenever we actually put out call for guest suggestions, your name always comes up. So I think the listeners are probably already familiar with you, but why don't you do a late description of what you do and where people can find you.
Go about it all backwards. Yeah, I write BC Today, which is a newsletter focused on all things BC politics. I cover the province quite closely on a daily basis. You can find our work, because we also cover Ontario and Alberta, if that is your thing, at politicstoday.news. You can find me tweeting live question period coverage and the introduction of bills and the biweekly COVID briefings at BC Today Official on Twitter. And then my personal account, which is these days mostly screaming into the void, is No Bitter, So Sweet.
Excellent. Thank you for joining me tonight and for stepping in and filling out Ian's shoes for the day.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. I don't think hadn't moved before, so I've never done the co-hosting thing, but yeah, no, good to be here.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you for joining me tonight. Have a good rest of the week.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.